This is side two of session 30, recorded on February 12, 2007. So we're just going to finish up the commentary on the end of the Thompson, William Irwin Thompson section of our book. What were you saying, Scott?
I was recalling that little performance thing that McLuhan did, where he was demonstrating something about the effect of the movie projector or the movie theater, and he took a movie projector and he was projecting white light onto the screen, was reflected light, but there was no film content.
And he was saying that was his movie.
Yeah, and I was saying, you said that the movie was the eye and the, was it the foot and the...
Extension of the eye and the foot.
Extension of the eye and the foot. And I said, well, there's no content. See, I think of the foot as being the fact that you can see people moving around through space, so it kind of extends your ability to travel in a way, so that's the aspect of the foot. And I was thinking, well, if it's just white light reflecting off the screen, there's no foot. But in the interval here where we're flipping the tape over, it occurred to me, well, the movie projector itself is made up of wheels and gears and reels. And he said that the wheel is the extension of the foot. So I'm wondering if that's part of what he was saying when he said that the movie is extension of the eye and the foot.
Yeah, no, that's partly it, because he said the movie was a hybrid medium. It was electric and mechanical.
Mm-hmm.
It was a combination of both. It wasn't like radio, just pure circuitry. So you have the wheels of the film rolls, the mechanical part, and then you have the electrical part, which is the light. So it's a hybrid. So your part about the wheels and the extension of the foot is partly true there. But generally, I think we interpret it as the fact that you travel in the interior landscape projected by the movie experience.
Right. But if you're looking at reflected light on the screen, there's no content. There's either no travel, unless your mind projects into the...
Right. Now, here's what you got to understand about... this is like post-grad one, which is actually the beginning of understanding McLuhan. You describe the movie as an extension of the eye and the foot. But you have to remember that when you're extended in one medium like the movie, the other senses in the body rally and complement the effect. And so maybe with no content... and just the light, one remembers their kinetic experience when watching movies and fills in that and therefore becomes aware that there is a kinetic subliminal in the movie experience just because he leaves it out.
Yeah, well, you know, also, you probably still might see the flicker of the frame. No, you wouldn't even see the flicker of the frames unless...
No, focus on not just the concrete definition of the experience or of the obvious image. Think in terms of how the other senses complement. For example, when you had Gutenberg Galaxy and the print world, what did the other senses do? The main cliche that people could think of and be familiar with is... it was the great period of classical music. The ear responded with a renaissance and geniuses of acoustic space. And then on top of that, you had the invention of opera.
Yeah.
So you see, the other senses respond to the bias that is the hidden ground or the constitutive effect of the new technology of communication, and that's where culture comes from. Culture deals with the other fill-in by the other senses. And you get new forms of culture.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, this is until you get that point, you haven't begun to understand McLuhan. But it is a hard point to get at first.
Well, I hear what you're saying with respect to the book culture causing the ear to want to fill in with music, but I don't really get it with if you're looking at the reflected light of a movie projector off the wall. It doesn't evoke the foot to me.
Right. But here's the point. McLuhan is doing this in 69-70. If I remember, that was when the interview was, and he was proposing this in a film magazine, cinema magazine. The movie is no longer constitutive and invisible environment. You've had the television, the computer, and the satellite by 1970. So people would have the opportunity to become aware of what that old environment was. Just as we, Thompson uses the principle, we become aware of the old environment and its qualities once we're inside a new invisible water, like the fish, not aware of the new water it's in. So you would become, because you would want to fill in the movie kinetic experience, and McLuhan denies it, you become aware of it. And it's all inside a room. It's an artificial environment. It's not the movie experience itself when people lived as an environment in the 20s and 30s and went to these things daily, you know, several times a week. You see what I'm saying? So it's a way of retrieving the memory of what the senses did.
Mm-hmm.
So you're definitely, yeah, not going to get the movie experience, but he doesn't intend you to have a movie experience. He wants you to become aware of what the movie medium had done to you and what bias and what sensory responses it evoked.
Mm-hmm.
You get that?
Yeah. But you're saying that we were already in the electric environment by then with television, so he was... kind of, it was the afterimage of the movie.
That's right. Now, let's not just say electric, because that begins with a telegraph, and the movie is electric. We'll say you're into the post-mixed corporate media global theater world caused by the satellite.
Well, I meant electric beyond, like you said, the movie was a hybrid electric and technical.
Right. The movie
by the time we get to TV, well, there's no mechanical.
Here's the difference. Movie, he defined as light on, like a book. Light reflected off the wall.
Right.
Whereas television came right at you, went through you. That's light through.
Mm-hmm.
That's the big difference qualitatively between the movie experience and the television. So movies are still part of the mechanical book world in terms of light reflecting.
Mm-hmm. Now, did he make an analogy between the TV with light coming through and the stained glass windows in the cathedrals where the light would come through and you would have this kind of sense of spiritual illumination?
Yeah, no, that was a major metaphor he used, and he got that, or it is a major metaphor at the end of Finnegan's Wake. So he was, again, translating Finnegan's Wake and updating that major motif in Joyce and applying it to television. And he said Joyce knew that it could be applied to television also. But yeah, that is a major metaphor for McLuhan describing the light-through experience.
Mm-hmm.
And why television retrieved medieval sensibility.
Oh, it did? In what sense?
Rock and roll, the wandering troubadours. Think of Bob Dylan and the folk singers.
Oh, yeah.
And there's lots of other things, but we probably covered that in the McLuhan Quadrant. I want to move on to the next section of the book.
Okay.
We've just finished the Thompson section, which went from page 49 to 73 on the right-hand side of my book. The left-hand side is made up of LaRouche going from page 4 up to 82, and then Croker takes over on the left-hand side from page 84 to 106. Yes, 106 inclusive. So what you have here is we have done LaRouche up to page 64, parallel on the, and that's on the left-hand side of the book. On the right-hand side, paralleling LaRouche, has been McLuhan and Thompson. We don't get Croker on the right-hand side paralleling LaRouche. You have Croker on the left-hand side, the same side as LaRouche. All right? So there's, I don't know if I talked about the beginning of the book, but there's patterns on why two are on the right-hand side and why two are on the left-hand side. But Croker, even though he's on the left-hand side, he is juggling and responding to McLuhan, Thompson, and LaRouche. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Since this is a dialogue between these different thinkers. So we're going to go into what became known as the postmodern form of thinking in the 80s and 90s. And Croker is an expert in the what he calls the postmodern scene. That's the name of his one of his early major books. So... well, we discussed Croker at the beginning of this tape session when I discussed each author. So now we're going to do Croker, and we have not finished LaRouche, which is page 64 to 82 we still have to do, but we're going to do that after Croker and bounce the LaRouche themes, which we've explored for many hours at the beginning of our sessions, bounce LaRouche off of Croker, Thompson, and McLuhan, all three. So that's why I want to bring in Croker now. Before we finish LaRouche. Okay?
Good.
So the very first quote is from a book called The Postmodern Scene, and let's just look at the facts at the index at the back. It was co-authored by Arthur Croker. Croker and David Cook. Arthur Croker is a, at that time, in the late 70s, early 80s, maybe in the early 80s, he arrived at Concordia University in Montreal, Quebec province, in Canada. He had taught at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg in the 70s. And his colleague is David Cook, who was a professor of English or humanities at the University of Toronto. David Cook was an expert on Northrop Frye. So you have Arthur Croker and David Cook are the co-authors of this book called The Postmodern Scene, and the subtitle is Excremental, which means like feces or shit, Excremental Culture and Hyper Aesthetics, put out by Croker's own press, his own press called New World Perspectives, out of Montreal, and this is 1986. Now, in academia, the postmodern thinkers were prominent, were starting to be studied in the late 70s, early 80s. So by 1986, in academia, the postmodern scene is something that could be commented on as a meme or as something that was familiar enough that you could start to play with the idea. And that's what we're going to have with Croker. Like McLuhan, Thompson, and LaRouche, they dance on their respective audiences. You know what I mean? Dance on the toes.
Right. Yeah, by the late 80s, wasn't there a magazine called Simulacrum?
There was the journal, the publishing enterprise out of Columbia University, started and run by Savelle Lautrengue, and it was called Semiotext.
Semiotext, that's right.
Yeah.
I remember I had a copy of that, or it was a... it was in book form, and I think it was a compilation of articles from the magazine, from the journal.
Well, it was a journal in the 70s, but then he started making little books, and Savelle told me personally that he modeled it on McLuhan's paperback, The Medium is the Massage. So these were little handy paperbacks, small paperbacks you could carry around in your purse or your pocket. Mm-hmm. You wanted it for people to be able to read on the subway and that. So it's sort of like something tactile.
Yeah.
Handle.
I remember being excited by it because the digital technology was just coming in, you know, as being all the rage. And so science fiction writers like, who's the guy that wrote?
Gibson?
Gibson, yeah, was coming into vogue. And Max Headroom was a TV animated guy who would cruise cyberspace. And then Semiotext comes onto the scene, so the chip body is really starting to put its thumbprint on the culture at that time.
At that time, it's the chip landscape. It's an environment. It doesn't become a body until we get into the 90s, and it really starts to get shrunk. You know what I mean?
Mm.
With compression, you have the mixed corporate media environment in the 70s and 80s is what the postmodern people are commenting on.
Mm-hmm.
The global theater, but it is shrinking, and Baudrillard is talking about it as a hologram, and it's starting to become a chip body, but not in the 80s, technically, in my terms. It's still a global environment. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that raises the question, or maybe begs a slight little more definition, because I remember recently I was talking about the TV landscape and the TV body, and then I remember that you said that, it didn't become the TV body until such and such a time. And I thought, oh, yeah, so when does it go from landscape to body? It's like, when does TV go from landscape to body? And then when does chip go from landscape to body? And why does it all of a sudden become why do we call it a body when
right.
we used to call it a landscape?
It's basically, let's call it in the 90s. Because when digital compression allowed, in, you know, broader bandwidth, allowed people with their computers to hear radio, to watch video, to look at books, look at movies, all those media, which in their own phases earlier, when they were constitutive and environmental and hidden, they were landscapes. They were new natural environments that people lived in, all right?
Mm-hmm.
But when the digital comes in the 80s and 90s, start to shrink those things. So you're not watching a one-way broadcast, analog media TV broadcast. You're there, and you can save it and click on it and watch it at your own time. And it's on your little screen. It's not something you're watching in the living room with the family, or your
But TV never TV never becomes interactive like that. So when why does TV become a body?
Okay, yeah. So when these former huge landscapes and environments, what McLuhan called a medium, become miniaturized and compressed, and inside the interplay of all those media, which is the global theater, and the global theater is getting smaller and smaller, okay, so that by the 90s a kid has all these massive media environments in their palm pilot, or in their palm, and in a very handy and tactile, pocketable technology, we have to realize that the body, the what we call the chemical body, or what people generally call the physical body, but I call the chemical body, the physical body is again becoming bigger in an innocent perception than the media it's being surrounded by. So look at the form, the human form, becoming gigantic again.
Mm-hmm.
But it is not limited to the physical or chemical form, because it's now got extensions of itself, miniaturized, and we could call them appendages. So you add the TV appendage to yourself, or you add the computer appendage. And I used to say that the popular expression of adding the TV environment as an appendage, or like an organ, or like a body part, the expression of that was people tattooing themselves. The popularity of that, because that was them expressing the fact that TV, which was tattooed the whole planet in the 50s, 60s, 70s, now is tattooing your body.
That seems like a reach.
This is a major point. I think I've said
what
this.
What do you mean the tattoo, the TV tattooed?
Oh, you didn't know that? Okay, McLuhan, if you read Understanding Media, he talks about television. Because it's an extension of the tactile sense, and the tactile sense is not just the interior central nervous system, but your skin, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It touches, since it goes through you, it touches your skin and also touches your brain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, tactility is an interplay. So the interplay between the skin and the central nervous system is a tactile relationship in itself. So television tattoos your brain and your skin.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people all of a sudden start tattooing themselves in the 80s and late 80s,
early 90s. I think of a tattoo as being an image that's fixed on, it's like a brand, like being like branding an animal or something. I don't get the metaphor how TV's tattooing your brain.
You mentioned the branding. What is the phrase of marketing of the last 10
years? Branding.
Okay. And that is the people falling back on a familiar icon,
mm-hmm.
something that props up the sense of stability.
Oh, yeah.
And the TV landscape, as it shrunk, became the TV body, because the form that the TV landscape was an extension of has become bigger than the media, again. I don't know if, maybe originally for cavemen, the bodies were bigger than speech, but that's arguable. The point is that as the body became bigger than the TV, the expression that your TV is there, your TV body is there for something you fall back on, is like having a brand on you or a tattoo.
Mm.
But it's not just the image that the tattoo creates, it's the way the tattoo is made. Remember, it's a little dotting process.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Little pinpricks.
Right.
That is what the television does to the brain.
Hmm.
It imprints. It's a pixelated dot image.
Yeah.
That goes through you. So tattooing is almost a tactile experience when you get one.
Yeah. Plus it takes environments and brands. For instance, you take the whole Nike environment, all the people in that, guys and the marketing guys, and put it all down to a little check mark.
Yes.
Which is an icon.
More or less.
But see, I can see the digital shrinks down because it'll you can start holding it in the palm of your hand and manipulating it. But when does TV shrink down to becoming so that the body becomes large in terms of the TV? Because the TV
is inside the digital environment.
Oh, so we don't have a TV body until we get into the digital environment.
That's right. The development of previous media environments as bodies is caused by the digital technology.
I see. That's when radio and TV and satellite all can become part of the what you call the body.
Right. And now the digital environment, that's a landscape, an environment in the 80s and into the 90s. But somewhere in the late 90s or up to now, the chip body begins to shrink.
Mm-hmm.
And when you move past that, where are we? What environment are we in when the chip body is being shrunk? It's being shrunk by chip technology, but the effect of it is that you are bigger than even the chip landscape.
Yeah.
And that is what I talk about, that position, that reality we're in now.
Right.
But we're going to do me later.
Yeah, we're doing Croker now, and we're doing Croker before the chip body.
Body, that's right. He is the expert on the chip landscape and its effects.
Yeah, okay.
Because the postmodernists, if they're seen as post-McLuhan, are dealing with the computerized world, the mixed corporate media, digital world, the digital world, telecommunications. Most people didn't know McLuhan talked about that stuff, because since he wasn't that well-known in the 70s, he came and went in the 60s, and people just associated him with TV. They didn't know that he anticipated and predicted the Internet and talked about digital technology in the late 70s, and many of the postmodernist insights were already laid out by McLuhan, if you knew how to find them in McLuhan's writings, or knew where to find them.
Mm-hmm.
But that was McLuhan's era. He faded out. He died, moved on. And so people influenced by McLuhan developed the post-McLuhan stuff, which is called postmodern. And once the postmodernists were popular by the early 90s, or well-known, people then, if they were lucky, would go back and read McLuhan and say, you know, McLuhan was Canada's first postmodern thinker.
Mm-hmm.
They started to realize McLuhan was more of a postmodernist than a modernist.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and the postmodernists, the guys who developed the postmodern philosophy, were already building off of McLuhan. They knew about McLuhan.
They all did, yes. I mean, the main names are...
Baudrillard.
Yeah, Baudrillard, Jacques Derrida, two guys named Deleuze and Guattari. Forget Deleuze's first name. It begins with G. And then Felix Guattari.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, Gilles Deleuze. Gilles Deleuze and Felix Guattari, they wrote books together. And then an art critic, aesthetician, Lyotard, Lyotard, his name was Jean Lyotard. Then there was Foucault, Michel Foucault, and Paul Virilio. Virilio was a friend of McLuhan's. Derrida, and Roland Barthes, Barthes. Derrida and Barthes subscribed to McLuhan's explorations in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
They were younger, but they were aware of the journal, and this is what Ted Carpenter, McLuhan's colleague, says. He was the editor and ran the subscription list for explorations in the 50s, and he remembered their names on the list.
Mm-hmm.
So he had Barthes and Derrida. Baudrillard, his first public article was written in 67, approximately 67, 68, was a review of one of McLuhan's books.
Mm-hmm.
And he admits that, you know, he works from McLuhan. As a matter of fact, he's the one who sort of appreciates McLuhan more than the others. Barthes and Derrida tries to refute McLuhan. Virilio, being a friend of McLuhan, certainly knew his work, but claims that McLuhan missed this and that, and Virilio developed stuff that McLuhan didn't develop. And Michel Foucault, I talked to a professor in New York City who was an expert and friend of Foucault, and he said he'd never heard Foucault talk about McLuhan. But Foucault certainly was aware of McLuhan, and McLuhan was aware of Foucault, at least the earlier Foucault, not the later Foucault, because McLuhan was dead. But let's see, who else did I mention? So we got Barthes, Derrida, Foucault.
No women, huh?
Lyotard. Oh, wait a minute. Now you have Deleuze and Guattari were aware of McLuhan and comment on him at some point in their writings. Let's see. the women were Lucy Irigaray and Julie, what was that? She wrote The Desire of Language. For some reason, I can't remember her name, but she was a psychiatrist, a famous postmodernist thinker. I don't know if they wrote about McLuhan, because they being basically feminists, took the view that Yoko Ono took, almost. Now, Yoko Ono told me that when she met McLuhan with John Lennon in December 69, she said, "I saw that he was right, so I went in the opposite direction."
Well, what did that mean?
She went back to content with a feminist take, maybe.
She saw that he was right?
Yes.
So what? Why did she want to run away from it?
Well, it's the male-female dialectic.
Oh, I see.
It's like McLuhan was the last correct male, now it's time for the women to say something.
Oh, gotcha.
And, I mean, Yoko was seen as a transitional figure as feminism took over in the 70s. She was a person who was seen in the late 60s as subservient to Lennon and ruined the Beatles, you know, those popular images of Yoko Ono. Yet she herself was already an established artist in the New York avant-garde since the early 60s. But that wasn't seen in pop culture in her association with Lennon. But what happened is that by 71, 72, she brings Lennon to New York and introduces him to all the art world, and he's totally sort of influenced by her. And that is the period when feminism starts to surface in the media. And so I've seen people see that Yoko was a transitional figure and an early feminist before there was feminism.
Oh, okay.
Popular mind. So I interpreted Yoko's statement as going to content or to some avant-garde use of content. Now, what's interesting is that content was the ground, as McLuhan knew, by the late 60s, because the satellite environment was starting to shrink under the digital effect. The instant replay was now the new environment in the early 70s, and it was all just content was the ground. Form and content had merged. So, and that's where the conspiratorial starts coming in. Who's controlling the content? And that's where you get Watergate and the anti-trilateral commission thinking in the 70s. So I see Yoko as in some way the female appropriation of culture, which had been in the 20th century and the province of men. So that is maybe what she meant.
Well,
she said going in the opposite direction.
Yeah, Lennon was trying to figure out how to manipulate the form and content of the media with his love in his bed in. Loving things and stuff. And
yeah, they meet McLuhan in late 69, and they've been dominated the media in 69. They had the bed in and got married in like March, April 69. They showed up, I think, at a rock and roll concert in Toronto in the summer, and then they planned to have a big festival in December 69 in Toronto, sort of organized around Ronnie Hawkins, who was the leader of the Hawks, who were later become the band under Dylan, right?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe Lennon did something else in 69 in that period, too. So they were a big deal in the content of media.
Yeah, I think she was instrumental in getting the B-52s going. They were...
I didn't know that. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
But that's 10 years later.
Yeah, that's 10 years later. Yeah. How did you meet her?
There was a retrospective. In 2000 or 2001, I think it was 2000, at the Whitney Museum here in New York, there was a retrospective of all the avant-garde film makers and film movements since like the 40s in American culture. And they went on for months showing all these old films, and any of the filmmakers that are alive, they brought in and they have a day of their films, and the guy would talk about them and take questions. And I remember, was it Stan Brakhage, I think it was Stan Brakhage came, and I won't go into it right now, but I got to discuss McLuhan with him in public, because I knew he was interested in McLuhan. I'll just say this, when I brought up McLuhan, he said, "Any person who supports Wyndham Lewis is a friend of mine," which was an amazing statement, but fitting to the kind of mentality or persona that Brakhage developed. Anyway, so one night they featured Fluxus films. And it was one of the Fluxus photographers, Peter Moore, who did the pictures for the medium is the massage, that book.
Mm.
So Fluxus was inspired by John Cage. Cage was promoting McLuhan in the early 60s, so Fluxus certainly knew about McLuhan and thought about him and discussed him. So they were showing Fluxus films, and so Yoko was a Fluxus filmmaker. They brought her in. So in the question period, I got a chance to ask her.
Oh. So it's interesting to me, of all the postmodernists you just mentioned who were published and some of whom became famous within the movement, then there's Bob Dobbs running around in the hidden ground, doesn't even surface until, what, 90?
Well, 80? 92.
What?
The album comes out in 92.
92, and then CKLN is, 80?
87 to 91.
91. But here you're the hidden ground to all these guys, and nobody even knows who you are. You're invisible.
Yeah, I'm in the invisible environment. And of course, that's changing in April when Paranoia has me as the cover poster boy, and the article's called The Only Man Alive.
Yeah.
Anyways, I wanted to say about C-Mutex. I know that C-Mutex, I have a copy of The Way It Was in the 70s. It was a little newspaper, but it became a book by 83. Are you saying you were into the books put up by C-Mutex, or you actually saw a newspaper, or do you mean that big book, which was C-Mutex doing a whole issue, big issue on science fiction?
Yeah, I think that's the one I had, the big book. It was a soft cover, but it was large format.
Yeah, I remember at CKLN there were younger people who had that book.
What year did that come out?
87, I think.
Mm.
Yeah, because I think I have it, but I was...
I had been introduced pretty well to, was pretty familiar with Philip K. Dick by that point. And
Now, I didn't know that about you. I mean, I associated you more with New Age stuff, Terrence McKenna, John Lilly, when I met you in 95. I did not know that you were aware of that 80s stuff.
Well, Philip K. Dick was pre-80s.
He wrote in the 80s, but he became popular in the 80s.
Right.
I mean, he died in 82.
It was actually Terrence McKenna who turned me on to Philip Dick.
Okay, there you go. It's coming through your McKenna zone again.
Yeah.
But how did you discover C-Mutex? Because that's not something that...
There was this weird fetish bookstore in my neighborhood in Silver Lake, and they were called Amok. They used to distribute through the mail order, but their physical location was in my neighborhood.
Is that that thing that was up, came out of Washington, out of near Seattle, Port Townsend or something, Port Washington, Seattle, AMOK Press?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah, they had all kinds of...
And they would stylize the letter AMOK to look like it came out of some Aztec ruins or something like that.
Right, and you could order all kinds of stuff from their warehouse, but you're saying they actually had one bookstore in L.A.
Yeah, they had a physical location, and...
Well, that would have a whole variety of stuff.
Yeah.
So so that's how you discovered it. I mean, you weren't even aware of Severo Lutrenti. You saw the book, but you didn't know its tradition or where it came from.
No, I just got excited because it was a new meme.
Yeah, and interesting essays. I mean, Hakeem Bey is in that, all kinds of people. I think even Reverend Stang is in one of those science fiction collections. There's an essay or something about the Church of Genius in there.
Mm-hmm.
If you have it, you might take a look at it again. But there were a lot of popular writers of the 80s. Avant-garde or underground writers in that collection.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
now,
so...
this is...
But they didn't use the word postmodern. You wouldn't know that you were looking at a postmodern book.
No, I wasn't really familiar with that terminology.
I mean, that's university life, and you weren't part of that at that point. So
I'm
the postmodern...
aware that the ingression of the chip landscape, chip body was on the way in.
You say the ingression?
Yeah.
That's a good word. Okay, so what's that mean? Why do you bring up that? What's that got to do with knowing the postmodern writers?
I'm just saying that my familiarity with the material was because of the chip landscape was developing all around us.
Yeah, but you weren't aware of the material.
But I wasn't aware of the postmodern
writers,
no.
But you just recognized the word C-Mutex.
Yeah, and you know, Lully had written books like, such as the Simulations of God and like that, and so it was a natural extension to go from his idea of being able to go in internally into the flotation tank and simulate realities. And then there was this idea that, oh, now we're actually doing it with computer matrices, and that's called a simulacrum.
And did he use that term?
No, but it just was a natural, it just followed.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I had thought about that, but Lilly would be, more than Leary in a way, a transitional thinker from the New Age psychoactive drug world into high-tech kind of stimulation.
Yeah, he thought a lot about, but he wasn't calling it the digital body. He called it the solid-state entity.
Yeah, yeah.
And he thought that it was alive, and he thought that it was, that there was this, at first he saw it as being a conflict, almost a battle of survival between what he saw as a solid-state entity, which I think he thought was probably some kind of cosmic intelligence, which was crystallizing through silicone and beginning to take over the, you know, carbon-based life forms on this planet.
Yeah,
but then eventually he didn't see it as being a threat. He saw that we were in a symbiotic relationship.
Did you say eventually? Yeah.
Yeah.
But you're saying the term solid-state entity, it was another term for the silicon.
Yeah, right, the chip.
Yeah, the chip body or the silicon substance or the silicon landscape that was replacing the carbon landscape.
Yeah.
Solid-state entity. Okay, so when I think of him and being worried about this thing that came alive, that's like Philip K. Dick worrying about, what was it? Begin with V, Vitalis.
Oh, Valis?
Yeah, Valis is this living intelligence that made him think that it was like a living hologram that had been created back at the time of Christ and was still running people, and he had a very paranoid relationship to
it. Yeah, but he thought it was some, you know, angelic, demonic form or something. It was Lilly who was thinking in terms of cybernetics.
Right, so they are transitional figures, complementary out into the...
Remember, Lilly back in the 1970 probably wrote programming and metaprogramming in the human biocomputer. He was already creating, he was already thinking in terms of...
Well, that's when P.K. Dick was writing. He got all paranoid about...
Yeah, but P.K. Dick thought there was somebody really out there that was after him or something, and Lilly said, no, this is just the brain projecting simulations.
Right, so on my chart, they represent, we could say that Philip K. Dick is the paranoid LaRouche quadrant, and Lilly gets to the McLuhan schizophrenic quadrant, not so paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at, and then Thompson is...
Well, isn't paranoia implicit in schizophrenia?
Yeah, yeah. But if you see how McLuhan is playing with schizophrenia, Lilly is more like that eventually than you're saying Dick is.
Yeah.
Dick remains paranoid.
Now, Lilly thought the whole cosmos was some kind of big computer matrix. He said that we lived he said that when you became conscious, you became an agent for Earth Coincidence Control, ECHO, Earth Coincidence Control Office, Earth Coincidence Control Office was a subset of the Solar Coincidence Control Office, which was a subset of the Galactic Coincidence Control Office, and that there was these feedbacks going on, and that if you were in tune with the cosmic computer or biocomputer or whatever, that your life would be lived through synchronicity and coincidence, which would be dictated through the interplay between the Galactic, Solar, and Earth Coincidence Control Offices.
Right, so I'm thinking that Lilly is more in the Thompson quadrant. He's not paranoid schizophrenic. He's hysterical. Now, that's the Thompson is the computer landscape quadrant on my chart. So what you have, as you move into the digital, and the TV landscape is going to become the TV body, and the computer landscape is going to become the chip body, in that period where the computer is becoming the body but hasn't arrived at it, it's therefore that the old mainframe computer metaphor being transformed by the integrated circuit, transistors and semiconductors, moving into the microprocessor level, in that transition period from the old huge computer mainframe zone and its image, Lilly is processing the shrinking of that big thing. but he's still looking at the computer as his metaphor, whereas actually in the post-computer satellite environment, which is interplaying radio, TV, computers, books, newspapers, bulldozers, and oil tankers, all the interplay, Lily misses the interplay and just focuses on the computer. But that may be his image of the medium of the interplay. You know, because the interplay, you could say it's the satellite environment, but it could be just the beginning of the interplay based on computerization or digitization. So, you know, the ground of the global theater can be argued over. What's interesting, though, is that when the satellite is an environment, all the other mixed corporate media in it as its content create a coherent image, which we could call a hologram. It's Philip K. Dick who sees the hologram. So he's acting in response to the satellite effect, and Lily is reacting to the computer mainframe itself, or is similar to Philip K. Dick in dealing with the hologram or the simulation, which would be the satellite effect, and then the post-satellite digital beginning effect.
But don't forget, Lily's dealing with the wetware between your ears. He's a neuroscientist, and he's trying to figure out analogs between, you know, he's going into the flotation tank and realizes that you can actually program your experience of reality in the tank. You can project yourself into different worlds just by theorizing that they exist and then determining that you're, and then setting up an experiment where you go ahead and penetrate yourself into those simulations.
Well, that's why I put him in the Thompson quadrant, because he's bringing in other ways of using the chemical body's brain, the biological brain. He's still looking at the physical body. Whereas Philip K. Dick is dealing with the discarnate state, which is manipulated by some angelic demon, which could be the central scrutinizer running the computerized hologram environment.
Mm-hmm.
So these guys are definitely 70s figures in transition before you get to the Baudrillards and the postmodernists and how they're all synthesized into a new rapid-fire form of prose created by Arthur Croker.
Mm-hmm.
So I see them, Lily and Philip K. Dick, in the Thompson Quadrant, which wrestles with, according to my chart, the universal government. Not the solar government, but multidimensional.
That's right.
Realities, and then Dick and Lily have different metaphors for that.
Yeah. The thing that's interesting about Lily, though, is that because he was a scientist, he set up real experiments. He went in, he performed the experiments, and he got the results, and then he measured the results, and so on. I mean, he really did project himself into alternative realities. He didn't know sometimes whether he was projecting himself into an objective space that really existed in another dimension, or whether his brain was just manufacturing something that was as tangible as tables and chairs when you have your eyes open.
Right, so that the fact that he was a scientist, which is based on the Gutenberg Galaxy meme, the idea of matching and making a data prove and line up with an exact definition or an hypothesis, I have the printed book as a subplot in the Thompson Quadrant. So him being a scientist fits into the Thompson zone.
But he was also the dolphin guy, so remember, he's kind of into first nature there. He's communicating with the dolphins,
yeah.
And he's recognizing that their brains are the cerebral cortex in the dolphin is as complex or greater than that of a human being.
Well, that's what I call the Gaia emphasis. That's looking at an image of first nature and attempting to communicate with first nature.
Yeah.
The thing is about Croker and the postmodernists is that they look at the sociological underpinnings of science. They start looking at science as a cultural phenomenon, a culturally specific phenomenon coming out of, well, they have different causes, different media that they define as the crucible of science, but they're no longer sort of hypnotized by science. They're looking at it as a biased activity or a limited activity. And this all came to a head in the early 90s, maybe around 95, 96, when a scientist wrote a paper in postmodern jargon for, I think, the journal out of New York. Called Social Text. I don't know if it's still going on. But he was peer-reviewed as a legitimate postmodern article criticizing the enterprise of science. And he did it as a scientist undercover. And it passed the peer review, supposedly, of the editors and got published. And then once it was published, the scientists who did the article exposed them all as dupes of jargon. And if you actually read the article, it's totally ridiculous. But it kind of makes fun of and satirizes the sociological critique of science done by postmodernists. So he beat them at their game. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Became a big issue in cultural news. And I met the guy, Alan somebody, around that time, and talked to him about it. But the postmodern journal Social Text was embarrassed by this. And I think Andrew Ross was the editor, and I heard that he quit and went into law, though I'm not sure if that's what happened. That was a rumor. And the point is that this scientist making fun of them critiquing science is what postmodernism was known as. And, of course, the neocons and the conservatives in academia get very upset with this postmodern influence in universities in the 80s and 90s because they said they were ruining the kids' genuine ability to do science.
Yeah. We're really making LaRouche mad now.
Yes, yeah, and LaRouche hates, he's written a lot about the postmodernists in the 90s as the big enemies, satanic influence in academia and in America. But the point is that explaining the ground of science, as these guys did sort of sociologically, was what McLuhan did in the Gutenberg Galaxy and in his whole thesis of the mediums of message. So they were actually doing what McLuhan had already done. But McLuhan didn't put value judgments in it. And these guys, these postmodernists, put in politically correct value judgments or emphasize class warfare or gender warfare or racist warfare. You know, they in the group mind context of the 80s and 90s that McLuhan predicted would be effect of the satellite global theater,